We'll hear arguments next in 6997, Lockett against Ohio. Amsterdam, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. The case of Sandra Lockett versus Ohio raises many of the same issues relating to the constitutionality of the Ohio death penalty statutes that were involved in the Bell case just argued. However, in the Lockett case, there are also serious federal constitutional questions in regard to the procedures through which Ms. Lockett's conviction of a crime of aggravated murder was obtained. And because the Court will not and need not reach the question of penalty unless it affirms her conviction on the merits, I would like to devote some portion of my argument time to the issue of whether or not the federal constitution was violated in Ms. Lockett's conviction by improper prosecutorial comment on her failure to take the witness stand in her defense. In addressing this issue, let me, if I may, just describe very briefly the background of this trial and the respective theories of the parties at the trial. Ms. Lockett stands convicted and condemned of the crime of aggravated murder for a killing of Sidney Cohen, a pawn shop proprietor, in the course of a pawn shop robbery. At the time that Mr. Cohen was killed, the gun was in the hands of Al Parker, the chief state prosecution witness in this case. The prosecution's theory is that Parker, petitioner's brother, James Lockett, one Nathan Due and the petitioner, had conspired and planned together to rob Sid's Market Loan Company, that they had all gone there for that purpose, that petitioner had remained outside in the car, that the three men had gone in, committed the robbery, in the course of which, according to Parker's own testimony, Mr. Cohen snatched at the gun, and it went off accidentally, and although the killing was totally outside the plan of the robbery, he was killed. Now, the important thing to recognize...
You say totally outside of the plan, and I'm not sure what you mean by that, Mr. Amsterdam. They had bullets in the gun, didn't they?
I refer, Your Honor, simply to Mr. Parker's own testimony. If Your Honor will look at page 62, the question was asked, now, Al, the purpose to go to the pawn shop was to do what? What was the plan when you went to the pawn shop to do what? Answer, to rob. It hadn't been discussed, the killing, no, sir. Okay, that wasn't part of the plan, no, sir. That's what I mean, Your Honor.
Well, of course, I suppose on that theory, the perpetrators wouldn't need any bullets in the gun if they had no intention whatever of making use of them, would they? Wouldn't an empty pistol have done just as well?
Well, Your Honor,
they loaded it there, I recall.
There was a plan to... Yeah. They didn't go into the pawn shop with a gun. They went in with bullets. And they certainly did arm a gun which was in there. There's no doubt that the plan included using a weapon, a loaded weapon. But the plan did not include killing. It isn't one of these execution-style, kill-a-witness type of things, according to the prosecutor's own testimony. For purposes of the self-incrimination issue, however, what is important is this: that the prosecution theory, as against petition, is entirely that she was a party to this conspiracy to go in and rob. The defense theory was not that the petitioner didn't know her brother and Due and Parker, or that she was somewhere else. The defense admitted that she went with him to the pawn shop and sat outside. But the defense contention was that there was no plan to rob at all, and that she thought they were going in to pawn a ring. Now, all of the evidence which connects the petitioner with a specific plan to rob the pawn shop is Parker's testimony. If this court will examine the opinion of the Ohio Supreme Court, it will find that its whole recitation of the facts of the case consists of a recitation of Parker's testimony, with a statement that it was corroborated by the testimony of several other minor witnesses. What is significant, however, is that the testimony of those witnesses, while corroborating parts of Parker's and while consistent with a theory of petitioner's guilt, was also perfectly consistent with a theory of petitioner's innocence, including the very theory of petitioner's innocence espoused by the petitioner at trial, namely that she was just along for the ride. Now, against this background, the following things happened at trial. Petitioner did not testify. There was an unhappy incident in which her lawyer indicated she would take the stand, but she declined and did not. She called the only two members of the conspiracy, Due and her brother, whom the prosecution did not present, because Parker was the chief prosecution witness, and they both took the fifth in front of the jury, leaving all of the conspirators out of account as possible witnesses. And then, in the course of closing argument in the case, the prosecutor made the argument of which we complain. In a theme that recurs constantly throughout the argument, and staccato repetition underlining for emphasis the theme, the prosecutor repeated again and again, seven times in all, that the prosecution's evidence was uncontradicted and unrefuted. And the prosecutor closed, uncontradicted and unrefuted evidence. Nothing from the defense. No evidence from the defense. Now, our submission is simply that, in the context of this case, that is a would be taken by the jury to direct their attention to the defendant's failure to take a stand in her own behalf, and is therefore a forbidden comment on her privilege against self-incrimination, and vitiates her conviction under Griffin versus California. To argue this point, I think I need only make a factual analysis, if I may, of Parker's testimony, because I think that if one understands what Parker's testimony was about and how this case appeared to the jury, the Fifth Amendment issue can only be resolved one way. If you look at Parker's testimony, you will find that there are a total of 15 episodes which in any way could conceivably connect petitioner to the plot to rob the store. Now, by 15 episodes, I don't want to give the misimpression that there's a lot of evidence. First of all this is Parker's testimony. Secondly, many of these episodes are very minor details, quite consistent with innocence, as consistent with innocence or guilt. They're just part of the story. But when I say episodes, I mean scenes. If you conceive of it as though we were projecting a movie or making a movie of these events, there would be 16 scenes. And that's important because the question is who is available to testify to each of these scenes. Our submission is that the only relevant scenes, the only witnesses are Parker, the defendant, the other co-defendants. And therefore, when the prosecutor says our evidence is uncontradicted, the jury says who could contradict it? Answer, only the defendant.
Well, what do you do when you have as counsel and you have uncontradicted evidence? You mean you can't tell the jury it's uncontradicted?
I mean, Mr. Justice,
that's just at one point. Of course you can always say it's uncontradicted.
If you say on one occasion that the evidence is uncontradicted, that would be a very different thing than if you say it seven times, uncontradicted and unrefuted. It also makes a difference whether petitioner is the only person who can contradict or refute evidence. We're not arguing that the prosecutor can never say evidence is uncontradicted. What we are arguing is that the prosecutor's description...
If the defendant doesn't testify and puts on no defense, then the prosecutor cannot say that his testimony that he's produced is uncontradicted.
No, I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I would say
what
the prosecutor may not amass such a repeated...
Well, can he say it three or four times?
Depends on the nature of the case.
I don't see how you can do that.
Well, Your Honor...
I don't see how you can muzzle the prosecutor by your trial tactics.
Mr. Justice Marshall, it is one thing to affirmatively argue the credibility of a prosecution witness. It is another.
I know many, some cases I've tried, if you didn't let me say uncontradicted, I wouldn't know how to argue. Because I was so happy to have it uncontradicted. You can't say you muzzle a prosecutor that way. And as defense counsel, I'm for muzzling them, but I mean, you know.
Well, if the prosecutor does, makes an argument which invites the jury to say to itself, gee, the defendant didn't take the stand. If she had taken the stand, then if she had been innocent, she would have taken the stand. But she didn't take the stand, so she must be guilty. That, it seems to me, is what the privilege is all about.
Now,
the
do you think a jury, jurors, intelligent jurors, don't ask that question of themselves, even if the prosecutor had never mentioned a word about it?
That is certainly a risk which is involved in the system. But it is a square holding of Griffin versus California that that risk cannot be increased in any way by comment on the part of any of the parties to the proceeding. A prosecutor cannot invite the jury to draw that conclusion, even though the jury might do it itself, nor can the court. And a prosecutor's argument, which hammers home to the jury again and again, so that the jury must necessarily be thinking to itself, well, what we're being asked to convict on is the fact that the defendant didn't take the stand and answer the evidence of the prosecution. There's nothing more or less than a comment on the court.
And that he didn't put on any testimony.
Pardon me?
And that the defendant didn't put on any testimony.
Not in the context of this case. I can't mean that in the context of this case, because in the context of this case, the only testimony the defendant could have presented was the defendant's own testimony.
Mr.
I would
Amsterdam,
agree that the prosecutor can say, can direct the jury's attention to the fact that there were other available witnesses whom the defendant didn't call. But the very purpose of my analysis of Parker's testimony was to show that, in fact, there were no other witnesses in this case.
I trust, Mr. Amsterdam, you're not going to consume all of your time on this question. There are other questions in this case, and I think you may fairly assume that some of those who voted to grant certiorari in this case were interested in those other questions.
All right. I think that it may make sense for me to pass to the death penalty questions at this point.
You can answer this one, yes or no, though. Was there an instruction in this case, any instruction from the court as to the significance of the defendant's not testifying?
Yes, there was. There was a one paragraph.
That says no significance should be attached to it? That says no significance should be attached to it?
That is correct.
Yes, thank you.
That is correct. All right, then if I may move to the death penalty issues in the case.
This first question is covered in your brief. It's covered in your brief, is it not?
Yes.
The first question, yes.
The only thing I had wanted to point out, Justice Stewart, because it was not dealt with in our brief, since it was raised only in the respondent's brief, was the notion that there were other witnesses who could have testified, going to Justice Marshall's question. The answer is, on the facts of this case, there are no other witnesses who could testify to any relevant events that split the difference between the prosecution and defense theories. If I may move then to the death penalty questions. I simply want to speak to two of the several constitutional attacks on Ohio's death penalty, because I think it's important to point out their relationship. One is the one of which the court heard argument this morning, that the Ohio death penalty statute is too narrow, too much circumscribes consideration of mitigating circumstances to meet the command of the Woodson and Roberts cases, that individualized consideration be given to circumstances of offense and offender. The second argument, which is raised in both Bell and Lockett, is the argument that the application of the death penalty to a person who was neither a participant in the killing nor an intentional perpetrator of any act that was directed toward killing affronts the proportionality principle of Coker and earlier cases. Because just as much as Ehrlich Coker, Sandra Lockett may be a felon, but not a murderer, not a deliberate taker of human life. Now, I want to point out, though, that there is a relationship between those two arguments, because in combination, they produce still a third constitutional contention, which is the narrowest conceivable ground on which these cases could be decided. Inasmuch as the very circumstance which we contend precludes the death penalty totally, That is the fact that Sandra Lockett has been condemned for a crime which she didn't do, didn't attempt, didn't intend. That is a killer. Inasmuch as that factor of the case is one of the very factors whose consideration the Ohio statute precludes, this court could decide these cases simply on the ground that whether or not it would be constitutional for a state to impose a death penalty in a case like this, it is unconstitutional for the state to do so while forbidding the sentencer even to consider the mitigating circumstance that the defendant was not the perpetrator of the crime and neither intended nor did anything in furtherance of the killing itself as distinguished from the underlying robbery. Now, that argument and the arguments about the narrowness of the Ohio statute in preclusion of consideration of mitigating circumstances.
Are you asking us to abolish the concept of felony murder, felony homicide?
Oh, Lord, no, Chief Justice Berger. There's no attack here at all on the felony murder concept. As far as conviction goes, that's perfectly appropriate. But if Coker has any meaning, one of its meanings must be that if the defendant's conviction, conviction rests only on the felony, that the death sentence, which is being imposed not for the murder but only for the felony, is disproportionate. Our argument goes only to the death penalty. It has nothing to do with the constitutionality of felony murder as a basis for conviction. That's perfectly accepted. What I think it is important to recognize on the facts of this case, however, is the fact that that is exactly what petitioner is. She is, at most, an armed robber. She has the mental state, the culpability, of any participant in any armed robbery, and no more than that. The prosecution in its brief suggests that the jury must have found that the defendant intended to kill Sidney Cohen because part of the element of aggravated murder is purposely killing. I want to dispel that theory right now. It is true that the court charged the jury that, but it also charged the jury, and this is the key to this whole case, at pages 118 and 119. Of the appendix. A person engaged in a common design with others to rob by force and violence an individual or individuals of their property is presumed to acquiesce in whatever may reasonably be necessary to accomplish the object. If under the circumstances it may reasonably be expected that the victim's life would be in danger by the manner and means of performing the criminal act, each one engaged in the common design is bound by the consequences naturally or probably arising in its furtherance. If the conspired robbery and the manner of its accomplishment would be reasonably likely to produce death, each plotter is equally guilty with the principal offender as an aider and abettor in the homicide. An intent to kill by an aider and abettor may be found to exist beyond a reasonable doubt under such circumstances. Now, later on that same page, the court defines intent as the same thing as purpose. And elsewhere in this charge, it talks about inferences as a very different thing from presumption. So what the jury was charged in this case was that it should find the defendant guilty of purposely killing Sidney Cohen if she participated in an armed robbery attempt. The Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court affirmed her convictions on exactly that theory. Indeed, the very issue which divided the Ohio Supreme Court here 4-3 would never have arisen on any other theory. So what we are dealing with is we are dealing with a case in which the defendant has been sentenced to die for nothing more than participation in an armed robbery, which at someone else's hands resulted in death. Now,
would the same thing go for James Lockett and Dew?
Their involvement could, on a factual record different than this one, have been shown to be more substantial.
Yeah, but how about on this record? How about James Lockett, for example?
Ms. Jessaway, you see, the problem with an analysis like that is we're talking about a record in which no lawyer was addressing the question of Lockett's culpability. And so I really don't, I just don't know the answer.
So you don't say that only the trigger man may be punished?
Oh, no. No, 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 no.
Who else may be? Anybody who had the intent that there be a death?
I think that this court has to look very carefully at what was involved in Coker and what is the rationale for which the court has sustained capital punishment at all. The question of whose finger was on the trigger is not important, but the question whether or not the defendant was a participant in a scheme aimed directly and deliberately at human life is very important. And this defendant was not a planner or a plotter in a scheme to kill. Now, whether James Lockett was or not, Your Honor, I don't know.
Well, arguably, under your rule, Parker perhaps wouldn't be subject to the death penalty either.
Someone other than Parker on this record might be.
But how about Parker?
Parker, well,
you said it was accidental. Accidentally, and that the plan didn't include any intent to cause death.
May I distinguish, as I did, Your Honor, two separate issues? The first issue is whether or not the death penalty may be imposed on these people at all as a matter of constitutional law. Mm-hmm. And the other is whether Ohio law may forbid consideration even of these elements. Now, I will go this far with no hesitation, that it is impermissible constitutionally for Ohio to forbid consideration of the fact that Parker's shooting was accidental. Mm-hmm. That I would say categorically. That is to say, even if the death penalty can be imposed on Parker, for Ohio to say, as it has, that whether he shot and deliberately and intentionally killed Sidney Cohen or whether the gun went off by accident is not relevant, may not even be considered in sentencing. That violates the Eighth Amendment. Now, whether Ohio could say that an unintended killing by someone who is in there taking steps toward killing with a knowledge that that is likely, that poses a difficult question. This case doesn't pose, because that's not Sandra Lockett. That might be James Lockett. It might be Due. It probably is Parker on this record, but it certainly isn't Sandra Lockett, because Sandra Lockett, at most, was aware of the fact that people were going into a store with a loaded gun. No indication of any plan as to how it would be used in answer to the Chief Justice's question, simply that bullets would be put in a gun. I take it that the idea of putting bullets in the gun doesn't necessarily mean to fire, because since the gun was being taken from the pawn shop proprietor, and since he would know that empty, it posed no threat, they would have to load it in order to pose a credible threat for a robbery. So there's no supposition whatever that anybody intended to shoot that gun. And, Mr. Justice White, our submission does not turn at all on whose finger is on the trigger. It is whether, to use the language of the great case itself, the defendant has been sentenced to death for a deliberate killing, which this defendant has not. If a defendant is part of a scheme in which somebody else shoots, that's just as deliberate as if the defendant shoots himself or herself. I would like to leave some time for rebuttal, and although there are other aspects of the case, I think that this has sufficiently presented the interrelationship of the issues, and particularly the narrowest ground of decision, so that it provides a good stopping place, unless the Court has further questions.
Very well, Mr. Amsterdam. Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to turn directly to the death penalty issue first, and then if there's time remaining, I'll address the prosecutor's comment issue. I'd like to point out to the Court that this was not an accidental killing. That would be contrary to what the jury found, and that the evidence in the appendix supports Al Parker's testimony, and in fact, there is a plan to commit a robbery in which it is reasonably foreseeable that deadly force will be used.
What verdict should the jury have returned if they were persuaded that it was an unintended, accidental killing?
If it was accidental, it would have to be not guilty. If it was unintentional, there's a difference in Ohio. If it's accidental, it would have been not guilty. If it was unintentional, in the sense that they didn't have what we now determine or call purposeful, but before it was an intentional act, it would have been involuntary manslaughter under our statutes.
Can you have accidental homicide in a felony? Mm-hmm. In the commission of a felony?
No, and that's the point I'm trying to make, that it wasn't an accident.
You said it could be an accidental one. I thought you were saying something you didn't really mean.
No, I didn't.
At the common law, there could be a felony murder that was purely accidental. In other words, a cat burglar climbing up a slate roof could dislodge one of the slates and strike a pedestrian on the head and kill him, and that would be a felony murder at common law.
I don't believe
That's
under our
law
state
of
law, that is not the law, no, sir.
At any rate, the jury could have returned a verdict of less than the degree they did had they believed the testimony.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And The testimony was not just Al Parker's. Joanne Baxter testified concerning the planning and the use of a weapon by this group on two different occasions. And the petitioner, in this case, dreamed up the idea of robbery. She thought of, and it's in the appendix, that we could pick out this grocery store named Easter's. But you got to get the dude. He's big and he's got a 45. So it's in her mind, it's in the conspirator's mind, that force will be used. Now, they didn't sit down and plan, I'm going to go in and kill this guy and then rob him. No, but the idea of aiding and abetting, the idea of felony murder, is established in Ohio.
Well, let me ask you a question, if I may, Mr. Lane. I understood you to say in response to Justice Stewart's question, I believe it was a moment ago, that Ohio does not follow the ordinary concept of felony murder, at least what I consider to be the ordinary concept of felony murder, and that is that if one goes into the convenience store with a gun intending to rob the proprietor, and the gun goes off accidentally in the course of commission of the robbery, he is guilty of first-degree murder under what I understood to be classical felony murder law.
Ohio presumes the intent or infers the intent that you would say is lacking in your example. In other words, if you can show the common law scheme of a felony murder, then the Ohio law says that each of the participants, whether or not they were the trigger man, has that intent or that purpose. But you have to find that they were part of it and it was reasonably foreseeable that force would be used.
What intent? The intent to kill or the intent to rob?
No, the intent to commit an offense.
Well, what do you think of this this instruction to the jury? It must be established in this case that at the time in question there was present in the mind of the defendant specific intent to kill Sidney Cohen. Does that mean what it says or not?
You have to find the specific intent through the inference coming through aiding and abetting and felony murder rule.
But somebody has to have had the specific intent to kill.
Right. But you can presume that from all the facts and circumstances in the crime itself.
Well, when you
which
say
Mr.
presume, do you mean the same thing as infer?
Yes, sir. Now, with respect to the mitigating factors.
Mr. Hoffman, just one detail. You mentioned the testimony about her actual intent. Doesn't the record tell us why she didn't go into the pawn shop?
That's correct. She didn't want to go in because she was known there.
And doesn't that suggest she really didn't expect the man to be killed?
I don't believe necessarily there could have been other witnesses there, other people who knew her from that pawn shop. I don't think that is a total answer to that. Turning to the mitigation phase, I would like to point out to the court that the Ohio Supreme Court in a number of cases has substantially broadened the initial conception or definitions of mental deficiency and psychosis, and I point them out in my brief. They are specifically State versus Black and State versus Bell, where they broaden the interpretation. And while it is true that you take all these factors in consideration in reaching one of the three specific statutory grounds for mitigation, the court does consider them. They do consider each one of the factors that the petitioner complains of, the age, the mental state, the degree of participation, all work together in reaching one of the statutory grounds. And I'd ask this court to compare this framework, Ohio's framework, with that of Texas, wherein any evidence of mitigation was not in and of itself a basis for mitigation, but had to be utilized in answering a specific question. And in Jurek, it was whether or not the defendant would be a continuing threat to society. Each one of those factors wasn't in and of themselves significant. The degree of participation, or the age or youth, or the mental state. But they were all taken in consideration through the judicial interpretation of the statute. And I'd ask this court to do the same thing with regard to Ohio. Ohio does consider these factors in reaching their decision. Petitioner claims that this mitigating factor never works. Well, that's just not true. Nathan Earl Dew was mitigated on this very ground, a co-conspirator of the petitioner. But Nathan Earl Dew was the dupe, the pawn that was directed by the petitioner who planned this, who directed them to go to Sidney Cohen's. She knew that there was going to be the likelihood of force, of violent force in reaching the robbery and carrying out the robbery. Therefore, you have the rule, at least in Ohio, the felony murder rule, and the fact that aiders and abettors are punished equally with the principal.
Mr. Hofer, are you saying that she had knowledge that Dew did not have?
No, I'm not suggesting that, but she's the one that
Under the statute, how is there a principled way to differentiate between the two, give her the death penalty and not give it to Dew?
Because in considering, as Black defines, the third mitigating factor, the mental state, the emotional state, and the degree of participation in it, she was the mastermind. She directed this person. And you look at Nathan Earl Dew's mind, his emotional state, and you look at Sandra Lockett's, and she's more culpable. And when you talk about, well, do you have to intend to commit the murder or intend to kill, I say no. You can consider, though, that in mitigation. But it shouldn't be in and of itself the mitigating factor. But it is considered in Ohio's framework in 2904B when you consider the nature and circumstances of the crime as well as the history, character, and condition of the defendant.
May I ask you about degree of participation? You say the Ohio court may consider it. It doesn't fit within the language of any one of the three specified mitigating circumstances, does it? Would you point the language out to me? We talked a good deal today about the third mitigating circumstance, that is, that the offense was a product of psychosis or mental deficiency, but under which one of those terms would you include degree of participation in the crime?
Well, I think it could be considered under any one of them in that, in reading the first part of it under the first paragraph of B, when you consider the nature and circumstances of the crime in reaching this.
Was the jury so instructed in this case specifically?
Your Honor, the jury does not take part in the final sentencing.
I haven't checked the opinion of the Ohio Supreme Court since you made this point, but did the Ohio Supreme Court in this case construe either one of these terms, psychosis or mental deficiency, as including degree of participation in the crime?
The Ohio Supreme Court did not make an express determination on that issue. But I'm saying that you can consider all of this evidence.
Is there any decision of the Ohio Supreme Court that does so include the degree of participation within the language of the statute?
Not those specific terms. As I stated in State versus Black was the most recent broadening. It talked about the mental state and the things that go into your mental state or your emotional state. And I'd like to point out that it seems to me that you can consider whether there was a cold, calculated plan by the petitioner to carry out a crime as opposed to some bizarre behavior or some unplanned kind of behavior. And look at the degree of participation in that sense in reaching the mental state or the emotional state of the defendant.
That doesn't say mental state. It says mental deficiency. I agree with what you say. My difficulty is whether or not it comes within the statute and whether juries are so instructed.
I'm referring to, Your Honor, a broadening interpretation by the court of that specific language. It's State versus Black. And it's cited in my brief, the citation in Ohio Supreme Court is 48 Ohio State 2nd 262, which broadens the interpretation of the definition of that particular statute.
And we are to read the statute as interpreted by the Supreme Court of Ohio. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes. Yes, Chief.
Mr. Hopeful, I shouldn't perhaps dwell on this, but what about the disparity between Parker and Lockett? How can the state of Ohio conclude that Parker did not commit aggravated murder and that Lockett did?
Your Honor, I think that's answered in Gregg and the other cases in terms of the necessity for plea bargaining. The court approved plea bargaining, and when you're considering that, you're considering something different than what's before this court today. The use of mercy, the use of plea bargaining are, as I understand it, not the same kinds of considerations as you have in this case.
But it has accepted a plea from him which necessarily was a determination that he did not commit aggravated murder, wasn't it? And now in a separate proceeding out of the same incidents, taking the position that Lockett did commit it. Isn't that right?
No, that is not correct, because Parker did plead guilty to aggravated murder, and perhaps
wasn't it murder without aggravation or something? I don't mean
without
have
an aggravating specification, which is necessary to get to the death penalty. You still have the same main.
What
charge.
Is the aggravating specification that justifies the death penalty against Lockett and was not present with respect to Parker?
Under Ohio statute, the aggravating specification was committing the aggravated murder while committing another crime, and this was, to wit, aggravated robbery.
Did she have the same opportunity to plead guilty to that lesser included offense?
Before trial, she was offered voluntary manslaughter. During trial, she was twice offered aggravated murder without the specification, and she refused both times.
In other words, that was the same degree that Parker.
During trial, that was the same degree. Before that, the voluntary manslaughter case would only carry with it a 4-to-25-year sentence, much less than even the aggravated murder case. But she didn't accept that offer.
Does this record show whether her counsel recommended that?
Yes, they did, and it shows that, and they did recommend it, and she didn't accept it. And it's on the record, at least in two instances, that they wanted to put in the record the offer's been made, do you want to accept it? And I don't know the rationale. There is one digression in the record where her mother's present and apparently has influence on the petitioner.
Is it a correct reading of the Ohio statute that whatever factors may have persuaded the prosecutor that a sentence of 4-to-25 years would have been appropriate in this case since she was sitting outside or whatever it might be, those factors could not be considered by the sentencing judge? He had to carry out the mandate of the statute.
Well, I don't know that I would say that those are the reasons that you went into the plea bargaining. Was the strength of the case, whether or not you could convict the defendant
on the judge has considerably less discretion than the prosecutor. That much is clear, isn't it? The sentencing judge.
I would agree to that extent, yes, once you've got to a conviction of aggravated murder with a specification.
Well, is it a question of degree of discretion, or is the question that they have totally different functions, that is, the prosecutor and the judge?
Well, obviously, that is true. They have different functions, and I don't know that that's the kind of questions that we're dealing with when you're saying whether or not this person has been offered a plea before the trial and then having gone through the trial, whether you have the same considerations to be facing not only the prosecutor but the trial court.
Well, it is correct, is it not, Mr. Hopeful, that if the defendant fails to establish any one of the three mitigating circumstances, the statute is mandatory in the sense that it requires the death penalty?
If none of the mitigating factors are found, that's true. Now, the petitioner contends that the death penalty is disproportionate for this petitioner because she did not commit the crime of aggravated murder with the intent to kill Sidney Cohen. But this totally ignores the rule of aiding and abetting and of felony murder as it's present in Ohio and in a federal case law, cases I've pointed out. And
his point, as I understood it, was not that she shouldn't be convicted. but she shouldn't be given the death penalty. Isn't that his point?
That's true, and I'm saying that it is considered. However, in relying on Coker and the disproportionality kind of argument, you're saying that she is less culpable than the trigger man, and I think that that's not the kind of thing that this court can say per se.
You're not talking about culpability. You're talking about sentencing.
True, but I think culpability is one of the things you use in determining whether or not the sentence is imposed properly or not. What degree of culpability, what degree of planning and participation did she have in this crime? Did she bring it about? And if this court is to say that the evolving standard of decency argument, as well as the disproportionate argument of Coker and Gregg, is to apply, then you would have to make a rule where a person who is classified as an aider and abettor or has a lesser degree of participation than the trigger man, then you have to overturn Ohio case law on aiding and abetting.
Well, this we're not involved here with a question of Ohio law. We assume the Ohio law has been settled by your legislature and by your Supreme Court construing its enactments. The question is that Ohio law in its application of this case compatible with the Constitution of the United States? That's our question. I mean, Ohio law could conceivably make any unlawful killing a murder punishable by death, and there might be no question about what the Ohio law was, so that a person speeding and hitting and killing a pedestrian would be guilty of murder in Ohio and punishable by death. That wouldn't solve the constitutional question of whether that or not the Ohio law, in its application to the hypothetical case I posed, was a constitutional law.
I agree with that, Your Honor. However, in this case, you have a very narrow category of murder that's before the court. Aggravated murder only applies to a very narrow category of murders. A person has to be either committing a felony murder or murder for hire, a very narrow group of them. And then, and only then, do you get to the question of the mitigating process. And when you review the nature and circumstances of the crime here, I think there's sufficient evidence before the mitigating authority or the punishing authority to say that the crime committed was of a degree of culpability meriting the death penalty. Now, I'd like to turn to the first issue, if I might, for just a moment, and discuss the prosecutor's closing argument. Petitioner primarily relies on Griffin versus California, which discussed the direct comment of the prosecutor that the defendant didn't take the stand and didn't see fit to explain the state's evidence. This is not the case here. The prosecutor in this case made the comment that the evidence was unrefuted and uncontradicted, but not directly.
But he also said that the defense didn't put on any evidence.
That's true, but that's not...
Well, I mean, it was in addition.
Defense attorney and a defense didn't put on any evidence, but two things I'd like to point out. The prosecutor's comments were not objected to at trial, and there was an instruction given regarding the defendant's failure to testify by the trial court that they couldn't take that into consideration, which was directly contrary to the Griffin instruction where they were told that they could take...
Well, it's not involved in this case. It's always been very interesting to me that the only person who can comment on the failure to take the witness stand is the judge, specifically the instruction.
But in relation to this, then, the state would urge that first there's a waiver issue under Estelle.
We have that case tomorrow.
And additionally, that it would be harmless error. Either one of these factors would be sufficient to refute the petitioner's comment. However, I don't believe that even in and of itself that the comments were such that they were error. I think you can distinguish them clearly from the Griffin case. Now, there's one other issue, the fourth one that's raised about whether or not this is a new interpretation of the aiding and abetting statute. And I would submit to the court that it is not a new interpretation. It is the same as it has always been. The Legislative Commission notes state that this is a codification of the old law. The trial court in its charge, as pointed out by petitioner's counsel, read the old law. The very quotes he gave you from that charge were the old law on aiding and abetting. Thus, there was no change, and the petitioner had notice. The old law was to be applied. I would also submit that this issue is one of statutory interpretation, and while, as Mr. Justice Stewart noted, that it is this court's duty to make sure that the statutes are interpreted correctly, it's still one of statutory interpretation, and absent a constitutional issue, which they've tried to bring into this case of retroactivity, of a change in the law, the statutory interpretation should be followed.
Mr. Hopeful, may I go back to the death penalty problem for just a moment? Under Ohio criminal practice generally, is it normally the practice to take into consideration the prior criminal record of the defendant in the sentencing determination?
Yes.
In non-capital cases. Is there any reason why it is correct, is it not, that the prior criminal record is not, the court is not permitted to take it into consideration in a capital case?
No, that's not correct. You can consider it, as I quoted the statute, you can not only consider the nature and circumstances of the crime, but you can take into consideration the character, history, and condition of the defendant. And the history clearly includes
yes, but just for the purpose of determining whether there was duress or whether there was mental, just for the purpose of determining one of the three mitigating circumstances.
That's true. I would like to point out
that in a non-capital case, it's given independent significance, isn't it? Isn't it the practice of the judge to give it independent weight in determining what kind of a sentence to impose?
It's one of the factors that is to be considered among many others in determining sentence. It's not just the single factor, but it is given some consideration. There are guidelines for sentencing in non-capital cases, just the way there is guidelines set up for the mitigation phase.
There are more mitigating circumstances that may be considered in a non-capital case than may be considered in a capital case.
There are more statutory enumerated mitigating factors.
Does that sound
factors?
Like a plan the legislature would have adopted if it hadn't felt that it was compelled to by the Furman case, do you suppose? Defend that really as a sensible way to go about the problem?
I think that because the court made its ruling that they wanted to set up some guidelines, but I don't think that it's necessarily constitutionally required that it have all the same considerations that you would have, for instance, even
in
Florida.
In a capital case, the judge would have less latitude than another kind of case.
No, he still...
That sounds weird to me, frankly.
Mr. Justice Stevens, you have the same ability to make these considerations in going and deciding the question of one of the statutory
but not the question
questions.
Of whether or not the capital sentence shall be imposed, the question of whether or not one of these three mitigating circumstances is present.
That's true, but in the same manner as in Texas, where they don't have this as a statutory basis for mitigation, you have to answer the question, is he going to be a continuing threat? You consider the past record. You consider the degree of culpability. All of these things go into answering that question. But this court didn't require Texas to set out as a statutory grounds any one of those factors specifically and say this is a statutory grounds for mitigation.
Do you think the trial judge in Ohio has as much discretion as the trial judge in Texas in deciding whether or not to impose the death penalty?
Yes, sir. I'd also like to point out to the court that the trial judge here has the benefit of a psychiatric report, a pre-sentence investigation. He has a great deal of information to work with in making his decision, and it is required by statute that the trial court have these bases for making his decision, so that the court does have sufficient information to look at the background and the condition of the defendant. And that's apparent in this record, where you can see that the pre-sentence report, the psychiatric examinations were all placed in the record and were considered by the trial court. If I might quote Justice Stewart in closing, in Gregg, Justice Stewart stated that there's a heavy burden which rests on those who attack the judgment of the representatives of the people, and the caution is necessary lest this court become the ultimate arbiter of the standards of criminal responsibility throughout the country. And I would suggest that this admonition applies equally well in this case, because we have a state that is not exactly like any other state. It's not exactly like Florida. It's not exactly like Georgia or Texas. But it provides mitigating factors which channel the discretion, give guidelines to the sentencing authority. And I think that it is sufficient to say that this case is not one of a mandatory death sentence. It gives sufficient guidelines to make the decision to the sentencing authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Amsterdam.
Mr. Amsterdam, before you start, will you tell us whether you're asking us to overrule Jurek, and if not, whether you agree with your opponent the Texas case. Your opponent argues that the Ohio judge has just as much discretion as the Texas judge, that the standards, that if we follow the Jurek case, why we have to affirm this conviction.
I disagree entirely. The dialectic is the same, as I disagree with counsel entirely. The dialectic is the same. That is, in Jurek, all of the background factors were considered relevant to a statutory question. That dialectic is the same. But it makes all the difference in the world whether the question is a broad question or a narrow question. The question in Texas was whether or not the defendant was likely to commit acts of dangerousness in the future. That is a broad question that opens up the defendant's whole life. And in fact, virtually anything is relevant to that. But the question under the Ohio statute, whether the victim induced the killing, what's the defendant's background got to do with that at all? Whether or not the defendant was under duress, the defendant's background's got nothing to do with that. Mental deficiency, I'll come back in a moment to speak to Justice Powell's question about what it means, but what it means is something very, very narrow. Yes, Justice Stevens, I agree that the dynamic is the same, but the problem with Ohio is that, unlike Texas, the statutory question to which the background is relevant is so narrow as to cut out most of the defendant's life, with the result that the kind of sending people to their death as a faceless, undifferentiated mass, which the court condemned in Woodson, happens in Ohio and didn't happen in Texas.
Now, let me take that last point you made. I'm a little confused. Suppose a woman hired a man to kill her husband so that she could marry someone else. Do you suggest that under Ohio law, or in imposing the penalty, that her background would have nothing to do with...
Absolutely. It would have nothing to do with...
What if she'd... what if the record showed that on one other occasion she had been charged with the same offense but found not guilty by a jury?
It has nothing to do with it, except if that
doesn't
is
show
defined
her state
as being,
of mind?
Except if that is defined as being provocation. But the Justice Stevens' analysis of the Ohio statute is exactly right. Unless one of those three factors is found, the death penalty is mandatory. And what that means is that every factor that doesn't go in to one of those three considerations can't even be weighed. It is irrelevant. Now, the breadth of those factors is the problem. If one of the Ohio statutes was as broad as question number two in Jurek, will the defendant be dangerous in the future, a question that opens up a whole life, we'd have a different problem. But these are narrow. And that brings me to Justice Powell's question. Justice Powell, might I direct Your Honor's attention to page 141 of the appendix, in which the trial judge here explicitly defined mental deficiency. The trial judge, now this is Justice Powell, the trier of fact. This is the trier who condemns Sandra Lockett on the findings of fact under the statute, because there's no jury. The judge is making a decision. The judge says mental retardation and mental deficiency under the law are synonymous. And then he goes on to read out of the DSM-2, that is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, second edition, the number categories. And he is saying that not only is mental deficiency identical to mental retardation, but if you don't have a score, if you have a score above 70, you're not retarded. That is why we say that all this business about how broadly the Ohio Supreme Court has construed the statute is nonsense. The only case in which the Ohio Supreme Court has given a broad construction to mental deficiency is the Black case. It did not apply the statute to any state of facts in the Black case. It was simply answering a constitutional challenge that the statute was void for vagueness. Wherever it has had to apply the term mental deficiency to a state of facts, it has said that educational deprivation is not mental deficiency. Cultural deprivation is not mental deficiency. Emotional deprivation is not mental deficiency. It means mental retardation. And if it meant more than that, this case would have to be reversed because the trial judge who found the facts found them on a theory that the defendant could be found to have a mitigating circumstance and could escape the death penalty only if she were mentally retarded. Now, that brings me back to the question of degree of culpability being considered. And if I may speak again to the felony murder question, because I think I've been very unclear on Ohio law as to this. And this is a key question. Several of your honors asked about it. I think it needs to be cleared up. The answer is that Ohio does not have the traditional felony murder rule that Justice Stewart and Justice Rehnquist were talking about. If you look at page 205 of the appendix, the Ohio Supreme Court says that it doesn't. Under Ohio, and this is not for aggravated murder, this is for first-degree murder at all, there's got to be a purposeful killing in the course of a felony. But what they then say is that any felony which is done with a deadly weapon creates a risk of death as its natural and probable consequence, and that one who engages in such a felony is presumed to have intended to kill.
Then they have a felony murder doctrine when the felony is committed with a deadly weapon.
It's the equivalent of that, Justice Rehnquist says. What it is that they have a different logic, but it reaches the same result. Most states say, if you have a killing in the course of a felony, you don't have to have intent, you've got felony murder. Ohio says you have to have an intentional killing in the course of a felony, but a killing in the course of a felony with a deadly weapon is presumed to be intentional killing, so you get to exactly the same result. And Justice Rehnquist, in terms of the answer to your question, presumed does not mean to infer. If Your Honor looks at page 117 of the appendix, you will see that the trial judge in charging the jury defines an inference for the jury. And that is very different from what it says about presumption on pages 118 and 119. This is not simply an inference.
Well, these are questions that courts, you know, in one opinion, you'll find misstate or confused, presumption and inference. I mean, I would not be willing to take at face value any one single statement in a charge to a jury as being conclusive on a state's law.
I would totally agree. But the point is that every judge who has considered this case below has taken the position that Sandra Lockett was convicted not because, in fact, she intended Sidney Cohen's death, not because the jury could have inferred that, but because Ohio law says that if you engage in an armed felony, you are presumed. The language in the judges in the Court of Appeals opinion, that liability is attached to the defendant, ascribed to the defendant. This is not language of inference. This is language that says the defendant is treated as though she intended killing Sidney Cohen, even though she didn't. And, Mr. Chief Justice, the answer to the question of what would the jury have done if it had found that she didn't intend to kill? The answer to that question is that this jury, following these instructions, could not have found that she didn't intend to kill. Because if they followed the instructions they were given, they had to find that if she engaged in a plan to participate in armed robbery, that she was presumed to intend to kill. So this jury could not have acquitted. The facts of this record are...
That's the law of felony murder that you've just stated, isn't it?
Well, It is the Ohio version, if you will, of the felony murder rule, although the trappings of it are different. The result is exactly the same. So what we have is a case in which the following are the facts, and not only resulted in the death sentence but were not even permitted to be considered by the sentencer. And here again is my major disagreement with counsel. These facts, because relevant only to three narrow issues, which do not in fact make them relevant, do not enter into the sentencing hopper at all. Defendant not only was not the trigger man, that's not terribly important, but the defendant did not herself participate in any plan or scheme that encompassed killing as a part of the design. Her culpability is no greater than
but
that
of
any...
The Supreme Court said that she participated in a plan where it was reasonably likely that a killing would take place. That's what it said.
Oh, I would agree that that factual finding is supported, but, Your Honor, what this Court said in Gregg was that the death penalty...
That's more than just saying it's presumed. Their bottom line was the Ohio Supreme Court that on this record Sandra Lockett intended to kill. That was their bottom line.
No, Your Honor, it's not. It isn't more, I think, than presumed.
Page 208. The record reflects that this was the case and establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant had a purposeful intent to kill. That's their bottom line, however they got there.
The bottom line is a pure and unmitigated fiction, Your Honor, isn't it? Isn't what the court said.
I know they say that if you engage in a plan where one of the reasonable results would be a killing.
Your Honor,
I'm just saying what they said.
This is just as Holmes once pointed out that even a dog knows the difference between being kicked and tripped over. Mm-hmm. And what the Ohio statute says is that if you trip over a dog, you are presumed to have kicked him. In short, the defendant's actual intent to participate in a killing is irrelevant. If the Ohio court deems that death may result from a dangerous robbery, the defendant is presumed, deemed, treated as though she committed the deliberate intentional killing, which this court...
This doesn't distinguish Parker from Lockett, I take it.
Nothing distinguishes Parker from the defendant in this case, except the state's decision not to treat him as a capitally punishable offender.
You said very vigorously that this was a fiction, but is not the concept of felony murder a legal fiction in the classical sense?
Your Honor, I have not the slightest doubt that the use of the felony murder rule is a fiction. And the question, as Mr. Justice Stewart put it, is whether life or death may turn on it. Certainly, some fictions can't be used in the law. The peonage case has held that. You can't forbid slavery, and you can't say anybody who breaks a labor contract is deemed to have intended at the time he entered into it to have defrauded, and therefore you can specifically enforce it. That's involuntary servitude. Here we say Ohio has done the same thing. It has used a fiction that treats a non-murderer as a murderer. And this Court said in Gregg that the death penalty was proportionate for deliberate murder. That's not the defendant saved by fiction. That fiction, we say, is unconstitutional.
Mr. Professor Amsterdam, you think it's a fair comment to say that the Ohio legislature, creating the problems we have here, misunderstood the court's holding in Furman?
Oh, absolutely. The two authors of the bill have said in their own article that describing what happened, that the statute with which we're confronted here was due to Senate amendments to a House version that wouldn't have presented any of these problems. Of course, that's it.
Well, you argued Furman. I say you argued Furman, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.